From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is back in session today, and lawmakers are facing a lot of pressure from protesting students who want gun controls and the NRA, which does not. On Fox News this morning, Republican Representative Steve Scalise, who survived a shooting last year, you remember, said about last week's school shooting in Florida, existing laws are not being implemented. And he pointed to the armed school sheriff's deputy who didn't enter the school when the shooting started.
In my case, the fact that you had two armed police officers there who confronted the shooter immediately saved not only my life, but all the other members of Congress at that ball field. Why did those breakdowns occur? And then let's focus more on addressing these problems in mental health that we've started to deal with in Congress. Let's close loopholes. Let's figure out what went wrong with government before people start talking about taking away the rights of law-abiding citizens.
So where are we on gun control in Congress? NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow joins us. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
And start with the call that came after the school shooting and after finding out that there was an armed sheriff's deputy who seemed to freeze outside the school. President Trump and others calling to arm and train certain teachers. Where does that idea stand in Congress?
Hard to tell whether it's something that would be written into a bill right away at this point in time, especially with lawmakers coming back into town right now. I think more broadly, we're just not sure what the response would be in legislative form. There's been a lot of proposals out there. You mentioned that of arming teachers. That's something that on the Republican side has gotten a lot of mixed support. You had Florida Governor Rick Scott saying last week that that's not an idea that he supported. High-profile Republicans on the gun control issue, like Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, have said they're skeptical of any sort of thing that would force teachers into arming themselves. So hard to tell with that one, but that's certainly something that President Trump has repeatedly returned to.
Yeah. Well, and also you mentioned Florida Governor Rick Scott. He's talked about wanting to raise the age at which one's able to purchase a gun. Now, the ages are all over the place. We understand in Florida you could purchase a long gun at the age of 18. It's said because it was said to be harder to hide a long gun like an assault-like rifle. But, of course, the shooter, you know, carried one in an Uber to his school. Handguns are at a different age at 21, but they can be at 18 if it's at gun shows. So there's different age ranges. But some Republicans in Congress have backed this idea. The NRA totally against it. We heard that again this weekend. Thoughts on that having any legislation?
Yeah, President Trump has talked about that a few times as well, and I think it's a very notable difference between the White House and the NRA. So I think that's one area where I really want to hear what House Republicans in particular have to say about whether there's any backing for that. That's something that has a lot of Democratic support. And we've seen a handful of Republicans here and there saying that they would support that measure. But it's important to remember, in terms of any sort of bill that would be brought to a vote in the House or Senate, likely would not happen unless a majority of Republicans support that idea. And I think right now, especially with the NRA being so opposed to it, I'd be surprised if a majority of Republicans feel that way. But, you know, we've seen on so many different issues, President Trump can change Republican opinion. If this is something he truly does care about and wants to advocate for, that could change some Republican minds.
Look, after the Las Vegas massacre, there was talk of banning bump stocks, those devices that make it easier to fire rounds more quickly. After the church shooting in Texas, there was talk of strengthening background checks after it was discovered that the shooter there had a domestic violence charge and the Air Force failed to report that to the database that would have kept him from buying a gun. I mean, the list goes on. After the Parkland shooting, there was talk about why all the concern about the mental health of this young man, all the 911 calls, all the calls of tips to different agencies didn't get followed up on. Is there any talk of this notion of red flag alerts, which states like Connecticut have, where any citizen can call in, bypass an agency that might where they might get lost, and go directly to a judge and say they're concerned about someone? Can you have a restraining order that will temporarily take a gun away?
There have been broad conversations about do there need to be changes to the ideas of court ordered, restraining order type situations. I think that is one of the areas where there probably would be bipartisan support to take a look at what sort of mental health evaluations could be changed, what sort of information sharing could be strengthened. I think there's a lot of areas on the margins there where probably if you talk to a bunch of Democrats and Republicans, there would be bipartisan support. But the conversation as a whole has been so polarized for so long that even though we've seen this remarkable week of activism and we've seen some big shifts in public opinion polls, I would be hesitant to predict big movement in Congress, especially fast movement in Congress.
And so, for instance, no return of the ban on assault rifles anytime soon.
That has not been supported for a long time in Congress, no.
NPR Scott Detrow in Washington. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in China, the Communist Party is setting the stage for President Xi Jinping to stay in power indefinitely. The party plans to remove a clause in the Constitution that limits the presidency to 2 5-year terms. Joining us now from Hong Kong is NPR's Anthony Kuhn. Anthony, tell us more about what the party is proposing here.
Okay, the state media reported over the weekend that they are going to take language out of the Constitution, which limits the president and the vice president of China to 2 5-year terms. Basically, every leader of China rules for a decade. But the thing to remember is that the president is not the highest office in the land. It's actually the head of the Communist Party and the head of the military, and those have no term limits. So now none of the top jobs have any term limits, and as it happens, Xi Jinping holds all three top positions.
And these term limits, by the way, have been in place for decades. Why were they put in place to begin with?
Right. They were written into the Constitution in 1982. China's previous ruler, Chairman Mao Zedong, had died in 1976 after decades of violent political struggles and revolution and famine. And the country decided it was time to make politics more regular, more stable, and more predictable. And for centuries before, Chinese leaders had basically ruled until they died. Even though they may have sort of retired in name, they tended to pull strings behind the curtain and kept on running things until they just couldn't. And so this was one of a whole bunch of reforms. The past 40 years has been a reform era, and along with it came legal reforms. The courts got some power to deal with injustices. The media were allowed to do a little bit of sort of watchdog journalism, all to constrain the power of the top leadership and make politics more stable.
So why make this change to the rules now? Is the timing important?
It is interesting that they're actually changing the Constitution to allow this arrangement. They could have just ignored the thing because in many ways it's just a piece of paper. What's said in the Chinese Constitution is often not observed, like, you know, the right to free speech, freedom of assembly and all these things. But they are going to change it, and that requires some doing. So what happens is the Communist Party's Central Committee, the top 200 people in the ruling party, propose these changes. And then next week, the annual session of the legislature, which is called the National People's Congress, meets for its annual meeting, and they are going to change it. It's basically a formality. They've never vetoed a law that the party's put in front of it.
So what does this say about President Xi? We've talked in the past about how many believe he is the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao. How has he gotten there? How has he achieved that status where the party would be willing to do this for him?
He's done a lot of things. He's basically cleaned out the entire Chinese bureaucracy of rivals, anyone who is considered disloyal, people who are cronies of other leaders or factions. He had this sweeping anti-corruption campaign all across the country. And also he's appealed to nationalism a lot with his muscular foreign policy. He says, you know, we've played a low profile role for long enough. It's now time for us to take our place in the sun, for China to go into a sort of renaissance. And he's declared a new era under his leadership.
Anthony, there are many people who would look at this and say, OK, leader of country decides to remove the term limits and rule as long as he wants. And that is a great concern. Are there people who are maybe not inside of China, but outside of China, voicing that opinion that this is a problem?
Yeah, inside and outside China, there's a lot of concern about this. China has been in this historical quest, not just for wealth and power, but also modernity. And, you know, the last Chinese dynasty ended in 1911 after you know, thousands of years of imperial rule. Basically, what one man says, what the emperor says, goes. And so there's a belief that things have got to move forward. It's really interesting that, you know, what a name that's come up a lot since Xi Jinping announced this, I mean, that he could possibly rule beyond his at the end of his second term in 2022, and he might never retire. That makes some people think of a man named Yuan Shikai. Now, when the last imperial dynasty fell in 1911, he became president. And 2 years later, he said, let's restore the empire and I'm going to be emperor. But people weren't having it. They're like, you know, we got to move forward. And so warlords rose up in rebellion and the whole population was angry and he had to scrap it. So that's what people are thinking about. This is, you know, people feel that history is moving backwards and people are very upset about it.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn joining us from Hong Kong. Anthony, thank you.
You bet.
So what goes on in the mind of a school attacker? Let's find out. Actually, John Ledoux of Waseca, Minnesota, never carried out his plan to kill his family, police, and as many students in his high school as possible. He was caught in a storage shed surrounded by his arsenal of pressure cookers and bombs after a tip from a neighbor. And John certainly doesn't speak for all thwarted school attackers, of which it's worth noting there are dozens. But his story is revealing. First of all, it's hard to charge someone for attacks not carried out. John took a plea deal, spent 2 years in juvenile halls and jail before returning to his family, declining probation and taking a felony charge instead. That angered some people. But John says coping skills and medication helped him see his skewed thinking. He's gone to college, is a welder. He doesn't think he deserves attention, but agreed to speak with us. John Ledoux, thank you so much.
Yep, no problem.
Well, and put this in context, it sounds like you were the kind of kid a lot of parents would love to have, a self-starter, good grades. When you were 8, gave your entire savings, $200, to a family who lost a father and brother in a home invasion. Can you explain, as you got older, you know, people were seeing this on the outside, what was going on inside?
I guess I mostly noticed it through my 7th and 8th grade years, how I just get more irritable with people and sort of grow kind of resentful of smaller notions they had. Like, it kind of bothered me watching people mess around. And I always remember when people were screwing around in the class, the teachers would always say something like, do you think they're going to allow this sort of behavior in high school? And when I got to high school, nevertheless, they did. And it's just far more obvious.
Yeah. Well, and you were someone who really wanted to learn. You told the Minneapolis Star Tribune, it bothered you that your German teacher knew more about German than you did. It bothered you that Mozart composed music at 5 and you were working on a guitar riff. You were really putting a lot of pressure on yourself.
Yeah, I felt like I should have been naturally doing much better than I was. And it just bothered me to see counterexamples of that everywhere I looked.
A lot of kids have anger in high school, but they decide maybe they'll come back in 10 years at the reunion and show everybody. I'll show everybody how well I did. When did it start to change for you to, I'm going to show them now?
There wasn't a distinct pushing moment. It was more a gradual build up of what I talked about earlier. I looked around and people were enjoying stuff and I was just kind of living day to day, just existing.
No.
So it was more fueled by my disappointment and frustration that led me to want to be violent, is because I wanted to feel satisfaction through dominance, basically.
That's what you told the police, that you were going to conquer. That's what it would be. You'd be on the top of the heap. But how much did you have a fascination with Columbine that apparently people didn't know about, Eric Harris?
That wasn't my inspiration. I more just, in terms of the one you mentioned, Eric, getting to know him through his writings, I felt I agreed with a lot of his attitudes. So that's pretty much how far that goes, though.
And you've described some of that, I think, this idea that I should be taken more seriously and I should have more. He expressed some of those same things. As you talk about this now, is this uncomfortable for you to explain these feelings? Does it make sense to you, I guess, is what I'm saying? I mean, are you thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe I once thought this?
Looking back, I can pretty clearly see how it led to it. But nowadays, when I look at it, it's very embarrassing. So, yeah, in that sense, where I say, what the hell was I doing? Yeah, I would apply that statement you just used.
Yeah. You were setting off small bombs in the woods, starting to build up this feeling. You get caught. A lot of doctors came in and said, first of all, they thought you had Asperger's with a violent indication. Later, it was thought that you had sort of a narcissistic issue with a severe depression.
My final evaluators, who I agree with the most, their diagnoses were three things. It was narcissistic personality disorder, unspecified personality disorder with obsessive compulsive traits, and major depressive syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Does that help you understand? I mean, narcissism, that's what I was thinking when you were saying, I should be the best. You were really good, but it wasn't enough for you. Does that give you a little bit of relief? I mean, have you been able to say, I don't have to be the absolute best? I mean, how has that, if that has that helped you?
It's kind of a bit more of an instinctual thing. I can rationalize that it doesn't make sense. Like now I can rationalize my way out of the instinct, but the feeling itself of I should be doing a better job, even if you're really doing really good already, it just doesn't go away.
It doesn't go away. So the feelings of not being good enough are still there. I'm so sorry. But you say you've learned skills to remind you that's not rational. But still, do you understand how people might be saying, well, wait a second, why are you out at all?
Yeah, I think if I was in their shoes, I would probably be saying the exact same thing.
Well, and what's your answer? How do you, are you sure you won't do this again?
Yeah, I mean, right now, my view on life is even if things go terribly, there's not a rational reason to involve harming other people into it.
Look, you've also had tremendous supporters. There was the woman from Russia who wrote you a letter. She said when she was a teen, she had studied the Columbine killers. She turned a corner, never acted on her darkest thoughts. She said, you know, how lucky are you? Do you feel lucky that you didn't act on yours?
I mean, I said I was going to and I felt I had to, but I don't really know how deeply I would have tried to act on them. Physically, it was making me feel sick and I was tired of it. So me being caught, I'd say, I am lucky.
Wow. So, but you were feeling sick about it. Part of this plan included your family, who you seem to love very much, your sister and parents. Is there a place in there? If somebody had a sign up at school, feeling murderous thoughts, come talk to us. Or, you know, is there something that could have stopped you before you were actually caught, given that you were feeling sick about it?
I don't know who it would have been, but someone to sit down and rationalize exactly what my thoughts are and why they're incorrect. That's what would have been, is just someone telling me I was wrong.
You know, this is what some of your fellow foiled shooters say. There's a man named Aaron who wrote an op-ed about this. He said, if I'd been able to have this conversation with somebody, something might have changed. So just talking to someone could help. But John, you've also told us it has to be couched correctly, because you've said that as a narcissist, if someone told you to go get help, you wouldn't have gone. You didn't think you needed it.
I suppose at the time I was more thinking that I don't need and I don't want any help. I felt I should have been able to handle things on my own. And I don't recall anyone ever telling me prior to that I needed help. So, I mean, maybe if someone said it due to my behavior, then I might have taken a bit seriously. But I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, and people didn't see things, which makes you very different from the Florida shooter, we should say. There were terrible signs of where he was headed. Very different. But you told us a story about a friend of yours that it just took one thing. It took somebody saying hi to him.
Yep, that was one example I used. Actually, off the top of my head right now, I can think of five people in Minnesota who are within my age group who have reported to me that they've had, at one point in time, serious thoughts about doing something like a shooting or attack at their school or something like that. And none of them done. Unfortunately, I found out just a few weeks ago that one of them committed suicide. I knew him a while ago, so that's upsetting.
Mm.
But that person you were referencing is a person I'm pretty close to now. So he was on his way to stab this guy, and the guy was down the hall from him. And there was one girl who she just happened to be nice in some way to him. He'd passed her, and I don't know if she smiled or said hi to him or something. But because of that, he decided not to go and stab the guy. And now he is working, and he's doing pretty well.
Hmm. Well, and so are you, we understand. You got your welding certification, a welder and fabricator.
Yep.
Started seeing a therapist again.
I'm currently not seeing her now because the clinic I went to, they closed down, and I just haven't gotten I haven't rescheduled it at this new clinic yet, but it's something I intend to resume very soon.
Because why? What does it do for you? I mean, again, you're someone who was diagnosed with a narcissistic disorder. Those people don't think they need anyone. And, you know, and now what does this mean to you?
Well, my depression is recurrent. So even if I'm not having some breakthrough each time, it's nice to have someone knowledgeable to talk to this stuff about.
Mm.
People who have made connections to me in the past, former therapists and state workers, I've gained a lot from them.
What would you say to someone hearing this that either worries about their child, that they're seeing signs now of somebody who might go beyond the I hate everybody at school, or somebody who's had these thoughts? What would you say to them?
I guess I'd ask, what do they want? And I think that you'll find that the people who are thinking about this sort of thing mostly want to do it because there's something that's not going right for them. Ask them what they want and then rationalize how they can get it, because you'll pretty much always find out that the ways you can get what you want are very attainable. I guess I'd make an analogy to life being like a car. If you steer it correctly, it can get you pretty much anywhere you want to go, but crashing it doesn't usually bring you to your destination.
Hmm. One last question. You are, in so many ways, not at all like the Florida shooter. But when these shootings happen and you see those faces, you know, on television, and the victims and the just the bereft parents and the fear, do you at all think, you know, what do you think?
Sometimes it really bugs me a lot where I need to verbalize some sort of command to my mind to, you know, shut up and focus on this. I need to say something verbal, even if I'm alone, just verbalize something to myself, even if it's swearing a lot, because swearing helps relieve a lot of stress. So,
well, we're so glad that you know that you didn't do that. You did not do that. John Ledoux of Waseca, Minnesota, we wish you all the best.
Thanks a bunch.
And by the way, if this is hitting home for you, as John just said, talk to someone. And tomorrow, a researcher who's been studying the dozens of thwarted young school attackers. What more can we learn?
Gentrification is an issue that many cities are dealing with. In Dallas, an old Hispanic neighborhood occupied by working-class families is becoming unaffordable, and one man is using piñatas to protest. Reporter Hadi Mawagdi has the story.
If you head to Oak Cliff, an old Latino neighborhood in South Dallas, it's easy to find shops filled with brightly colored piñatas. They've got traditional ones like stars or donkeys, Sesame Street characters, and even political figures. Artist Giovanni Valderas is an Oak Cliff native. Piñatas have always been part of his life, but now, in his studio, he's turning the party item into protest art.
I try to use colors that are associated with the neighborhood I live in and I've grown up in, so these bright oranges and bright greens.
Valderas calls his piñatas casitas triste. That means sad little houses in Spanish. And that's exactly what the piñatas look like. They're houses with big eyes and an apprehensive expression. Imagine a disheartened Thomas the Tank Engine. Valderas is placing his sad little piñatas on sidewalks in front of big luxury housing developments throughout Oak Cliff. He's trying to call out the developers and the city of Dallas for pricing residents out of their apartments and disrupting the existing culture.
What I like about the piñata is that there's this kind of subversiveness to it, right? In the beginning, it's really fun and festive, and you look at it, and then you start to get it.
What you start to get is that Oak Cliff is changing, and some people are worried about it. It's still a hub for Latino businesses. There's a quinceañera boutique next to a cultural center, next to a tire shop. But natives, like 25-year-old Sophia Weir, worry that the development is unchecked. She sees the demographics of her neighborhood changing, and she's concerned that longstanding businesses are going to be replaced by upscale shops. She loves Valderas' piñatas.
It's like tapping into your own knowledge and telling you something that you already know on a much deeper level.
And what is that? That it's telling you?
It's telling you that you're kind of taking advantage of people's culture when you want to, and you're not supporting it when you don't feel like it.
You can hear construction of a five-story apartment complex happening in the background of the trendy coffee shop and bookstore where I met Weir. That shop's part of the gentrification happening in Oak Cliff. But they've reached out to the community. They host a Spanish language book club, and they hire people from the neighborhood. That's the sort of engagement Giovanni Valderas hopes his sad little piñatas encourage.
My hope is that they, you know, pull at some heartstrings and make people think, like, oh, wait a minute. There used to be people who lived here. Most of them were Latino families. And wait, I'm helping, you know, push these people out. You know, maybe I should, like, reconsider what I do in this neighborhood and what impact it has.
So far, development hasn't seemed to slow down. But people are posting photos and sharing the message. Some have even taken the piñatas and placed them on their porch as a sign of solidarity. Valderas says they're disappearing almost as fast as he can put them out. For Here and Now, I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
Protests raged across Italy over the weekend. Milan saw rival demonstrations from the left and the right. In Rome, thousands came to the streets, some wearing shirts reading "No More Fascism, No More Racism," protesting a new wave of far-right thinking. All of this ahead of Sunday's elections for a new parliament and prime minister. And after a fascist extremist opened fire earlier this month on African immigrants in Macerata. NPR's Silvia Pagioli is in Rome. Silvia? Fascism is a flash word in Italy. Remind us why this is a particularly passionate moment.
Well, first of all, the election campaign has been going on for an amazingly unprecedented sort of racist and political ideological rhetoric. Italy has had 600,000 immigrants have arrived in the last 4 years, and this has really become the dominant theme. And you have the parties are sort of on the, there's a far right party, the Northern League, which is fomenting a lot of anti-immigration feelings. They're not the only one. There's this been unprecedented racist campaign slogans that many analysts fear have been encouraging violence. As you mentioned, this case in Macerata, where a right-wing extremist with who had a Nazi tattoo on his forehead, opened fire on five African immigrants. He injured them quite seriously. And he said it was in revenge for an attack, a murder of a young Italian woman, and the suspect there is Nigerian. So all this has fomented a lot of old ghosts in Italy that had, you know, a 20-year dictatorship with Mussolini, the fascist dictatorship. And, you know, Italy never really came to terms. It never had a Nuremberg. It never really had a defascization the way Germany had a denazization. And so these are old slogans that are really coming to the fore. And there are a lot of ultra-right wing groups that are also running in the election to try to get into parliament. It's a very, very tense moment in Italy right now.
Well, that shooter that you mentioned carried an image of Mussolini with him. And there's another far-right party that marches with Mussolini's straight arm salute. So definitely echoes of history. They're troubling for many. But we understand many of the people who are protesting are also protesting things like labor reforms and vaccines, you know, mandatory vaccines. Former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is involved here. He's the head of a center-right party. There's also the Five Star Movement. So what's that?
Okay, the Five Star Movement was founded less than a decade ago by a comedian, Beppe Grillo, and its claim to be an internet-based direct democracy. It attracted a lot of Italians who were disaffected with traditional parties. Its platform is openly populist. It's anti-immigration, anti-vaccination, and anti-European. The founder Grillo has praised both Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Donald Trump as strong statesmen. He's called them a blessing for mankind. And the party's call to lift EU sanctions on Russia is worrying a lot of Italy's European partners. Mm-hmm. While there's no proof that the Five Star has received financing from Russia, the news site BuzzFeed reported that its platforms, its web platforms, have posted content from the Russian outlet Sputnik, as well as many fake stories. So a lot of foreigners are very worried. And the fact is that Five Star is right now running in the polls. It's the most popular party in Italy.
And what about Berlusconi and his party, the center-right Forza Italia? Might he return to power?
Well, in fact, I think probably the return of Berlusconi is probably the biggest oddity of this entire campaign. The fact is that he cannot run because he, after a tax fraud conviction a few years ago, banned him from taking part in elections at least until next year. Nevertheless, age 81, with more and more evidence of plastic surgery on his face and assistance for his receding hairline, he's back running his campaign, mostly on TV. And he's promising what he always promised and never fulfilled, is to cut taxes. But what he has done is that he has put together a center-right coalition of parties, and together with two other parties, this is the coalition that that is now given the largest chance of perhaps winning and forming the next government.
Wow. I mean, really, what a time. Just the sense of the mood there, Sylvia.
Well, this weekend it was very tense. Here in Rome, there were no scuffles, but there was a very big rally, precisely an anti-fascist rally. It was many thousands of people gathered under ugly weather. It was raining very hard. And to say no more fascism, no more racism. On another part of Rome, there was a big rally against vaccinations. That's another issue that's picked up a lot of popularity by the populist parties. And then in Milan, there were clashes between some of these groups we were talking about before, the fascist groups and ultra-leftist protesters who were trying to disturb their rallies. So, and police had to intervene there. But it's a very tense moment. The Italians will vote on Sunday, but the actual fact is it's a complicated new election law, and it's very possible that we will have a hung parliament and that nobody will win.
Hmm. Oh, well. We're going to keep an eye on it through you. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli in Rome, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's go now to Berkeley, California, and the only museum in this country devoted to scents, as in smells. Somewhat ironic because much of Berkeley, from yoga studios to city council, is fragrance-free, no perfumes or even scented lotions allowed. Bianca Taylor from member station KQED went to this museum to sniff out the story.
The first thing I notice about the Aftel Archive of Curious Scents is that it doesn't actually smell.
I think, you know, people are worried that it will be very smelly, like a department store.
That's Mandy Aftel. She's a perfume maker who uses natural oils and is author of the best-selling book Essence and Alchemy. She founded this small museum in the garage behind her house in Berkeley. As she shows me around, she's practically vibrating with energy. Her black outfit is punctuated by her oversized purple glasses and cherry red hair.
A lot of people don't know the difference between natural and synthetic aromas, and I only work with naturals.
Aftel has made nearly all of the 300 scents in the museum herself. She says perfume is more than Chanel. Scented materials have been used in spiritual traditions, from Buddhism to Catholicism and Native American rituals.
Perfume has a very tangled history. There is kind of no civilization that didn't, you know, revere and want scented materials.
It turns out a lot of civilizations wanted one smell in particular, and Aftel has it at the museum. It's in a tiny bottle labeled Smell Me underneath a huge wooden carving of a whale.
It's ambery, but it's very kind of shimmery. It's got a kind of like a sparkly quality to the smell, if that makes any sense. And it's soft and deep, but also light. And
this kind of flowery language sounds like how someone would describe a fine wine or gourmet chocolate. The scent reminds me of a wet beach towel. It's ambergris, which is essentially sperm whale poop that's been used in perfumes for centuries. Not exactly my thing, but I do love smelling the cardamom and jasmine oils. Aftel says this museum is all about touching, looking, and smelling.
So it just brings you a lot closer to nature and how incredible nature is with smells.
And there is nature here. A taxidermied beaver sits in one corner next to a small replica of a musk deer. People made perfume from the oils of these animals. One of my favorite discoveries is a wooden chest of drawers filled with some of the raw materials that go into making perfume, like vetiver grass, juniper berries, cedarwood, and seashells. But the museum's main attraction is the perfume organ. It looks like a pipe organ, but it's not a musical instrument. It's kind of like a giant spice rack with three long rows holding hundreds of tiny glass bottles filled with colored oil.
And then you get a little packet with three scent strips, the really
Every visitor to the museum gets three strips of heavy paper to dip into these bottles. I test out a bottle of poplar buds, which look like egg yolk and smell like apricots and baby poop.
Oh my God. I kind of like everything I have to say.
Before she turned to the world of perfume, Aftel worked as a therapist. She thinks the connection between smell and memory is so strong that visitors can be transported to another place after smelling something at the perfume organ.
Because it takes them back right away. Like, people have a smell and they have a memory, and it just fuses together right then, kind of like music does for people.
The Archive of Curious Scents is only open Saturdays, and Aftel says people visit from all over the world. But talking with her, I get the feeling she would have been happy to create this museum, even if no one showed up. For Here and Now, I'm Bianca Taylor in Berkeley.
The National Rifle Association is speaking out against companies that are cutting ties with the group after the school shooting in Florida. The companies, including MetLife, United Airlines, Delta, and Hertz, announced they were ending discounts to NRA members. The NRA tweeted that the announcements were a shameful display of political and civic cowardice that would not scare or distract a single NRA member. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us now from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the NRA says it has more than 5 million members. They pay an annual fee of about $40, and they get a range of discounts. How big a deal is this boycott to the NRA?
Economically, it's not that big of a deal. Politically, however, it may be quite a big deal. First, on the economics, I mean, these discounts are commonly offered by large companies to large associations like the NRA, like the AARP. They amount to something like a small discount on flying to the NRA annual meeting. MetLife had an auto insurance plan where they gave NRA members a $50 benefit each year of claim-free driving. I mean, this is like ho-hum stuff, right? This is saving maybe a total of $50 to $100
right.
a year. That's not going to be a huge deal in getting people to sign up for the NRA. But politically, it's really significant. This is one of the first time I can remember that corporate America has essentially ganged up on the NRA, which is among the most fearsome of political lobbyist institutions. So I think economically, like I said, not significant. Politically, a pretty big deal.
And when you look at the individual companies, Delta's reaching out to the NRA to let them know we will be ending their contract for discounted rates through our group travel program. We will be requesting that the NRA remove our information from their website. As we mentioned, United also did the same thing. And American Airlines came out and tweeted, "To clarify questions we've received today, American does not offer discounted group travel rates to the NRA." But Derek, one company that has come under fire on social media for not ending a discount is FedEx. It has not ended its 26% discount to NRA members. Is there any risk for FedEx there?
Yeah, there's a risk. FedEx is making a bet that it can ride this out without a major boycott. And it should be said that FedEx is distinct from the companies you've named, like United and Delta, in a few ways. First of all, it's not quite a consumer brand in the same way. A lot of FedEx business is B2B, and so they're not
business
appealing.
Business to business, is what you mean.
Business to business, exactly. So they're not appealing explicitly to consumers. What's more, you know, FedEx is headquartered in Tennessee. That's a red state. So it's possible that its board of directors is a little bit further to the right of the board of directors of national airline companies. But it should be said that things can change quickly. Within a 12-hour period, Delta went from defending its relationship with the NRA as, quote, routine, to, within half a day, requesting that the association remove all information dealing with Delta from its website. So this stuff can change very quickly.
And there is already a call from the Boycott NRA social media movement for tech companies like Apple, Google, and Amazon to cut ties because these companies stream NRA videos. Is that likely to gain any traction?
I don't know. It's tough to make a prediction right now, except simply to say that, you know, clearly there's an aspect of herding behavior here. It can be a little bit like, imagine a slow motion avalanche, that as more companies join this movement to pull away from the NRA, it builds momentum, builds pressure for those few remaining companies in the spotlight of political activists to change their relationship with the NRA as well. I was online looking at some of the social activism on Twitter. There's one message with more than 30,000 retweets that sends people to an Amazon Twitter page that is pre-filled with text demanding that Amazon stop streaming NRA TV. So this is clearly a movement that picked up late last week, is continuing, and I would be surprised if no other companies joined along.
It does seem like corporations are taking a role that they haven't in the past. I'm thinking back to when so many companies pulled their members off of President Trump's corporate advisory
yes.
boards because of what happened in Charlottesville and his response to that. Are you seeing a new era of corporate activism?
I absolutely am. America's corporate community has become, I think, a quiet defender of socially liberal causes. You can go back to, all the CEOs that left the president's business council after Charlottesville. You can also go back to the NCAA pulling the March Madness games out of North Carolina after the transgender bathroom bill. You can go back to 2017, a letter signed urging the president to protect the dreamers. You can go back to 2015, nearly 400 companies filed an amicus brief urging the Supreme Court to legalize same-sex marriage, including basically every major company in America. So it's interesting because on the one hand, clearly these are companies that benefit from Republican economic policy, like the corporate tax
right.
cut, but they also have moved pretty significantly to the left of Republicans on social causes. And as a result, you often see them nudging Republicans from the left.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. We'd love to hear your thoughts on all these companies that have come out and said no more discounts for NRA members. You can weigh in at hereandnow.org. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.